This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. From about 1950 through the end of the 1970s, PCBs were commonly used in building construction and renovations. The same chemical additive that was widely used in electric transformers and dumped by General Electric into the Housatonic and Hudson Rivers for decades was also used in the caulk that sealed the windows and in the fluorescent light ballasts in your child's school. PCBs were banned in 1979, but they have a long legacy as part of hundreds of school buildings around our state. A new investigation by WNPR reporter David DeRoche shows just how many schools are likely to contain PCBs and why, despite health warnings, most schools are unwilling to test for them. We'll also dig into the science behind how PCBs affect human health, and we'll talk about how the Housatonic River and the downstream effects of the chemicals have been impacting people in the western part of the state. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, our number is 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. If you want to go online to wnpr.org right now, you can find David DeRoche's story about PCBs in schools and some maps that will help you understand a little bit more the scope of this issue. David DeRoche, who covers education for WNPR, joins us in studio today. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, John.
So before we get into some of the history of PCBs in so many school buildings, we started talking about this because of the discovery of PCBs at Hartford's Clark School. So let's go there first. What exactly happened to Clark?
So in December of 2014, the Clark School Building Committee found that there were PCBs in the school that were above EPA limits. So they decided to close the school. But prior to that, to them finding PCBs, they had done a renovation project in the summer of 2014 where they did not test for PCBs. So that got us thinking, okay, if they didn't test during the first renovation project and they tested for the second, there are probably other schools that do the same thing. They will test on some occasions and not on others occasions. So Hartford's did a comprehensive PCB analysis, found that there were PCBs in the caulk and in ceiling tiles that were less than 6 months old. They found levels that were several hundred times EPA limits in some cases, and so they decided to close the school. It was supposed to open in January, this coming January in 2016, but they've since delayed that again. They say that there's been a lot of problems just getting the approval through the EPA to get the remediation completed.
And we'll be talking about the costly remediation efforts in just a little bit, why schools might test and might not test. But you spoke with some folks, including Elaine Felder, who has a grandchild who's going to school, and some of the people in the neighborhood are understandably worried about this.
Yes. So Ms. Felder, who lives near Clark School, also expressed concern that she didn't really know if there were PCBs then coming from the school and into the neighborhood. So we have a clip from Elaine who's talking about some of her concerns and what she wants to see happen.
It was hard for her. I mean, you know, it was hard for her because all of a sudden she's just taking out of her environment for, as far as she would know, for no apparent reason. And then when she found out it was for health reasons, she was kind of reluctant about going to the other school because she felt that maybe this school has the same problem with this school. And because of that transition, I mean, of course, she had no other choice but to transition. She had no other choice, and it was a little difficult for her.
So she's talking there about her granddaughter, Desiah, who was at Clark School and now is going to another school, Wish School. This school also built within the same time period. So essentially what Elaine is worried about there, David, is does this school that her child's now in have some of the same problems that the old school did?
And that's a very legitimate concern. And it's really unclear whether or not Wish School has PCBs. But as you mentioned, since it was built during that time frame, it's very likely that it could.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of what your investigation found. When we started looking at Clark School, it became obvious early on that this wasn't the only school in Connecticut where there was an issue like this. As a matter of fact, the school district in Hartford has said out loud, and I think they should get some credit for actually testing for this school at Clark and doing the remediation there, because as you start looking into it, many, many schools across Connecticut very well likely might have PCBs in them, and most of the schools and school districts do not test. First of all, how did we find out that most schools in Connecticut actually have PCBs, probably somewhere in the caulk or the light ballasts or somewhere in the school?
So we know that the EPA offers guidance on determining whether or not PCBs could be present in the school. And they basically say any building built or renovated between 1950 and 1979 could be contaminated with PCBs. The state recommends school districts test for PCBs prior to a renovation, but they do not require it. They have no recommendation in terms of preemptively testing or proactively testing, just going through and doing an analysis of where PCBs could be in a building. So we know that that since PCBs were found in Clark, that has opened up a system, well, not a system, but it has opened up other schools, about 106 schools throughout Connecticut,
sure,
that have been found to have PCBs. And we know that those districts are at least looking at the problem. But we also know that even though they have found PCBs, that they've only been remediated in where they've been found, which means there could be in other places that were never tested.
So again, so that our listeners understand, between 1950 and 1979, most school buildings, as a matter of fact, probably most buildings that were built in our state and across the Northeast, where PCBs were widely used because they help in the elasticity of caulk, they were in many cases thought of as a very good building material because they had a very long lifetime warranty. They were resistant to temperature changes. These are in most of the buildings. The EPA and the state DEP essentially say, you know, you need to look at this. You need to test whether or not school buildings have PCBs in them or not, but they're not requiring it. They don't require that test, meaning it's up to the school districts. I have to ask, David, why do some schools test and some schools don't? I mean, why did Clark test in the first place?
Well, the reason Clark tested, well, the reason we've been told is that they were getting state reimbursement for the project that they were doing. So the state provides a document that that asks, have you looked at whether or not you have PCBs? And in this case, they filled out this form and they said, well, we should probably look at whether or not we have PCBs. But again, this is only a recommendation, not a requirement that districts do this. And I spoke to a man who used to do a lot of caulking, who's in the Brick Masons Union, and he did a lot of caulking. He said he used PCBs all over the place, and he did a lot of work in New England. Also spoke to an environmental consultant who said he estimated that 50%, at least 50% of the schools or of all buildings built between 1950 and 1979 could have PCBs in them.
And actually, let's listen to that environmental consultant. His name is John Insall.
This is a nationwide or a worldwide problem. It's literally everywhere. And so I think that if there was a mandate to go and test, I think there'd be a lot of pressure and lobbying against that, for the simple reason is we have a problem that we can't handle. And so, you know, given that it's everywhere, it would overwhelm commercial real estate. It would overwhelm the regulators with work plans and what to do about this. So from a practical matter, I think that there would be a lot of lobbying against a requirement.
There'd be a lot of lobbying, David, against the requirement because it would cost an awful lot of money. Look, we see what's happened at Clark School. The school is being closed down for essentially an entire school year. The remediation process is very cumbersome. You have to pass through a lot of EPA standards, and it's going to cost the district a lot of money. So essentially what we're finding is, even though the EPA and the DEP say you probably should test, most school districts are saying, you know, without a mandate, we really don't want to because we don't want to know what we could find.
That's true. And also, you know, after speaking with a lot of superintendents, one of the things they point out is if the state considered PCBs to be a real health risk, they would require the testing. So there seems to be some, if it's not misunderstanding, or confusion over the real health risks. And I know we have a PCB expert who's going to speak about these health risks later in the show. But just to say that there is that confusion, there's kind of a disconnect between the understanding of what the health risks are and then applying that in any kind of policies you make.
The EPA, for instance, talks about PCBs as a probable human carcinogen. The World Health Organization, on the other hand, says that they are a known human carcinogen. Just one of the many details that we'll try to dig into this hour as we talk about PCBs here on the program and what they mean in our buildings and in our environment and the outdoors. You can call us at 860-275-7266 if you have questions. You can also tweet us at Where We Live. Connecticut Technical High School system is among those systems where PCBs have been found. Your analysis, David, found that they were in more than 100 Connecticut schools. What did the Connecticut high school system do?
So the technical high schools kind of went about it in a proactive way. They said, you know, let's go ahead and check out all of our schools that meet these criteria. Any school that was built or renovated between 1950 and 1979, we're going to analyze everything we can and determine where PCBs are. And that doesn't mean that they've remediated all the PCBs, but they're in a situation, they're in a place now where the PCBs are either encapsulated or they've been remediated, and they have a plan moving forward as any renovations come out. They know exactly where the PCBs are, and they've taken upon themselves to kind of be proactive in that way. And
well, let's actually listen to John Woodbensee. He's the Technical High School System Security and Environmental Health and Safety Coordinator, describing what was found from some of these tests.
Once we got further into our investigation, we found that we had PCB in our caulking, in some of the expansion joints, some of, in and around some of the windows. We did find one school, or actually two schools, where we had some dust levels that we went back and cleaned up. No one was adversely, you know, no health effects or any issues like that, but we wanted to make sure that we eliminated any potential. And we had one school that had some elevated air levels that were, you know, again, something that we wanted to drop and make sure that it was within safe ranges or within acceptable ranges that we felt. And so we went back and did some changes to the air supplies into the building and also did some sealing of the caulking.
Okay, so that's how one high school system handled this. David, I know that you talked to a number of high school superintendents around the state. What did they tell you? I mean, what did you hear from school systems about either the requirements or non-requirements, about the warnings that come from the EPA, and about what they're hearing from some of the parents and students?
Well, so a variety of things. Some are informed of the issues. Some say we do test whenever we renovate. But very few, and I think only the technical high school system and perhaps Fairfield, the town of Fairfield, are the ones that have actually proactively gone out and tested. Again, it boils down to really a kind of confusion over what the real health risks are. A lot of superintendents believe that if it were health risks, then they would require the testing. And a lot of superintendents also seem to think that they've gotten rid of the problem by removing windows that could have caulking in them. But that's kind of the problem that happened in New York, where they removed windows without doing a proper remediation, and then that released PCBs into the soil, which then were at very high levels, which then had to be remediated. So there's a lot of confusion over exactly what the best thing should be to do, because there's kind of a gap between the science that we have and the EPA's recommendations.
And those EPA recommendations actually, honestly, are changing even under our feet right now. New guidance coming out from the EPA even just this month, David.
So the EPA just released its new guidance, which increased the maximum concentrations of PCBs that they recommended that are safe for children. So basically, a child under two can now essentially breathe in a higher level of PCBs than before, but there's really no science or studies that they show to really really provide evidence for this increase.
We're talking with David DeRoche. He covers education for WNPR, and he and some other WNPR reporters have been working on a long investigation, a multi-part investigation on PCBs in public schools in the state. You can find out more at WNPR.org. If you'd like to join us, you can tweet us at Where We Live or find us on Facebook at Where We Live, or give us a call at 860-275-7266. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Dr. David Carpenter, who's one of the leading researchers into PCBs. We're going to ask him a bunch of questions about how safe they are, what we know about the health impacts of PCBs. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, we're talking about the results of a WNPR investigation into PCBs in public schools. You can read more at WNPR.org. Our education reporter, David DeRoche, is here to talk through some of what he found about schools in the state that likely have PCBs somewhere in them, some schools that have found PCBs and have had to remediate at quite some cost. We want to bring in Dr. David Carpenter, who's director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany. He joins us by phone. He's one of the world's leading PCB experts. And it's good to talk to you, Dr. Carpenter. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, first of all, what are PCBs?
Well, PCBs they're not a natural compound. They're man-made. They were manufactured in the U.S. between 1929 and 1977 or 8. They were very useful for a variety of reasons. They're a heavy oil. They're good electrical insulators. They were basically used like we would use mineral oil today. But the problem is they're very persistent, and they stay in the environment, and they stay in our bodies for long periods of time because they have a lot of chlorines around the biphenyl molecule, and therefore it's difficult to break them down.
Mm. So as we said in the first part of the show, and this is one of the big controversies around PCBs, clearly people at the U.S. EPA feel as though there are health concerns around EPAs, but they essentially say that if undisturbed, they don't really pose a health risk. They are concerned about PCBs in buildings like the schools around Connecticut, but they don't believe that if they're undisturbed, they're going to cause any sort of a problem. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization lists them somewhat more dangerously as a known human carcinogen. What can you tell us about what's known, Dr. Carpenter, about how PCBs affect adults and children?
Well, there are a variety of things that PCBs do, and I would actually not quite agree with your characterization of EPA's stance. I think people at EPA view PCBs as very dangerous. They're caught in the bind, however, between what it would cost and how disruptive it would be to try to get rid of them. And therefore, in a regulatory sense, they have to sort of continue to allow some exposure. But people at EPA certainly understand these are very dangerous chemicals. Now, there was also already discussion of the fact that the World Health Organization declared PCBs to be known human carcinogens. And I served on that panel a couple of years ago. The evidence is really overwhelming that PCBs cause cancer. Now, one of the concerns here, when we're talking about PCBs in schools or in other buildings, is that if you're exposed to a chemical that causes cancer today, your cancer is not likely to appear for somewhere between 5 years if it's leukemia, up to 30 years if it's some other kinds of cancer. So you have kids in a building where they're breathing PCBs from the air, and they're not going to get cancer while they're in school. They're going to get cancer later. That's a dilemma. In fact, in my judgment, the biggest concern specific to schools, which nobody has mentioned yet, is it's well known that PCBs reduce IQ, reduce learning ability, cause disruptive behavior in exactly the same fashion that lead does. We've for years been dealing with lead in old buildings and taking it out and recognizing that the most precious thing you have in schools is teaching kids and their ability to learn and remember and grow into adults that have a functional brain that can allow them to have decent jobs and make a decent living.
So when you talk about lead, I just want to make sure our listeners understand, often when we hear about lead as a persistent problem, say in school buildings or in apartment buildings, we think about the lead that comes off in old paint and that a child may place in his or her mouth. Is that what we're talking about here with PCBs, Doctor? Do you have to put it in your mouth and actually physically ingest it? Or are you actually talking about the off-gassing of essentially PCB chemicals that come off of caulking that's sitting, cooking in the heat in the window?
Well, you can eat PCBs, and there's no question about that. And that's why there are advisories against eating fish out of the Housatonic and the Hudson and other rivers, because PCBs are fat-soluble substances. And in fact, we're all exposed to PCBs in ways that we really can't control because there's some PCBs in almost all animal fats. But the real route of exposure that's of concern in schools and in most buildings is the off-gassing of PCBs, and they go into the air as a vapor. You breathe them in. Your lung will absorb them because, again, they're fat-soluble substances. They'd rather be in your body than in the air. And the major route of exposure in a school is going to be inhalation of these vapor phase PCBs. Now, the PCBs, again, in caulk, they were used as we would now use mineral oil. But they are semi-volatile chemicals, and so they continually volatilize a bit, and that's part of the reason that over time the caulk becomes harder because the PCBs have gone into the air. So if the caulk is on the inside surface of the building, it's much more dangerous than if it's on the outside because then the off-gassing is right into the air in the classroom.
Mm. Hey, Dr. Carpenter, it's David DeRoche. Thank you for being on the show.
My pleasure, David.
I had a quick question about what you mentioned before about the cognitive problems that could happen as a result of inhaling PCBs. Across the country, and especially in Connecticut, we've seen an increase in the number of kids being diagnosed with learning disabilities, specifically ADHD, children with behavior problems. Do you think there's any correlation, or is that kind of a too far of a leap to make in terms of PCBs actually contributing to this increase?
Not in the least. There's definitive evidence that PCB exposure increases the risk of ADHD. And lead does exactly the same thing. Now, they're very different compounds, but they do the same thing. And, you know, again, you talk with teachers. My wife was a teacher for years. These kids with disruptive behavior really interfere with teaching the whole class. Now, I disagree with the comment made earlier by one of the people you're talking with, that there are no health effects that have been seen. Well, you know, you don't detect a health effect if a child's IQ is reduced by 3 or 4 points, and if they're more disruptive than they would have been if they weren't exposed. That's not considered to be a disease, and it's very difficult to quantitate. But that's exactly what happens when kids are exposed to these compounds in air.
What kind of studies have been done on that impact? Because obviously I think a lot of parents would be very, very concerned about long-term health impacts for things like cancer or diabetes, high blood pressure. But these are all things, as you've said, may present themselves even when the child becomes an adult. Many parents are going to be very concerned about any suggestion that exposure to these chemicals may lower one's IQ or may make one difficult to deal with in school. Do we have specific studies that we can cite about this? Because this is I think, going to be very interesting to many parents listening, Dr. Carpenter.
Well, yes, there are a number of specific studies. There have been a number of review articles. I actually have a book chapter that reviews the effects of various environmental agents, including PCBs, on ADHD and learning disabilities. I'd be very happy to provide information to you, to anyone else. There's probably a bibliography of 20 to 50 papers that have looked at PCBs and ADHD. There's a very nice review in the journal from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences called Environmental Health Perspectives a couple of years ago, where the senior author is Susan Chance from the University of Illinois. And again, I'd be very happy to provide references to scientific studies that document the point I've just made.
We're talking with Dr. David Carpenter, who's director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany. He's a leading researcher into PCBs. We're also joined by David DeRoche, who's our education reporter here at WNPR, who's done a long-form investigation into PCBs in public schools. If you've got questions, 860-275-7266. In just a moment, we're going to go to the Housatonic River, where PCBs were dumped by General Electric for years, and we're looking at the long-term environmental impacts there. Dr. Carpenter, I think one of the things that's also frustrating around guidance around something like exposure to certain chemicals is that so many different regulatory bodies seem to have very different stances. We talk about how the World Health Organization classifies PCBs. We talk about the internal scientists at the EPA maybe having one feeling, and then the external front-facing guidelines maybe being something else because of the politics surrounding it. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention seems to have even a slightly different take about who's most at risk for PCBs in buildings. Is it damaging that we have so many different standards, guidelines, ideas out there about just how dangerous the chemicals are?
Well, yes, it is damaging because it sends a confused message to the public. On the other hand, I think it's understandable. Let's talk EPA particularly, because EPA is a regulatory body. Obviously, there's a group of people, primarily from industries, that bristle at every regulation because there are costs involved. So EPA is caught between a rock and a hard place. Their challenge is to protect public health, but to do so in a fashion that doesn't destroy the economy, and they're a political organization, so they're obviously going to get feedback from industry when there are costs involved and regulations involved. That isn't to say that the people at EPA intentionally are ignoring the health effects. Now, in fact, with regard to cancer, usually it's the World Health Organization through the International Agency for Research on Cancer that sets the standard. And they have done that now 2 years ago with declaring PCBs, all PCBs, to be known human carcinogens. Now, the U.S. agencies tend to lag behind the World Health Organization by something like 2 to 3 to 5 years, but they'll come around because the evidence is overwhelming, and it's documented in a volume just published this year of the proceedings of that meeting, which is something like 500 pages of documentation that PCBs cause cancer. Now, there isn't a comparable document about PCBs' effects on the central nervous system, not by any federal or international agency. But what there is an accumulation of scientific studies by academic investigators that make it very clear that PCBs affect more than just cancer. They affect the brain, they affect the ability to learn, they affect ability to pay attention. And one of the interesting questions is, are the effects on IQ because PCBs reduce the kid's ability to pay attention, and how can you learn if you can't pay attention? So it's a complicated issue.
So, Dr. Carpenter, certainly this is a problem across the country for any school that's built during this time period where PCBs were used. And one example is in Malibu, California, where some really interesting PCB issues have unfolded. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening there?
Yes, Malibu is a very interesting case in point, and I think it raises the likelihood that what's happening in Malibu is happening everywhere. So there is an EPA standard set years ago that sets that if you have PCBs in an uncontained source, that is, not in a transformer or capacitor, but in caulk, for example, or in ceiling tile or paint where PCBs were used, if the level, if the concentration is more than 50 parts per million, that is hazardous waste and it must be removed under law. Now, that law does not say that you have to test for PCBs, but it says if you test and if you find those high levels, then you've got to get them out. Well, in Malibu, some parents became concerned about PCBs, and so they got testing done of several classrooms. There are three classrooms in a row. They tested the outside one and the other outside one. They didn't test the one in the middle. Both the ones that were tested had more than 50 parts per million, and they had to be remediated at great cost. The school board refuses to test the room in the middle. Almost certainly it has the same PCB concentrations, but they don't have to remediate it if they don't test. Now, EPA is in a quandary over this rule because there is serious evidence that high PCBs in an indoor environment cause health effects. But the implications of requiring everyone to test every room in an old school would have just enormous economic impact on local communities because there's no federal funds available for doing the remediation. So if a school tests and finds more than 50 parts per million, then it's the local community and the local taxpayer that's going to have to pay for the remediation.
And I can only imagine that if the costs are too high for some folks in Malibu, California, that indeed they may very well be too high for people in poorer districts around the country. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Sherry is calling from Southington. Hello, Sherry. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I want to say this topic and discussion is fantastic. Thank you so much for doing this. It's very interesting, and I love it. The second thing is my son's in middle school in the Southington School District, and I'm very concerned. It's kind of too late now, but about a year and a half ago, they started with major renovations. The school, we would go in there. There was a big discussion with all the parents. The parents were concerned about the air quality. Even my son would come in and say, oh, Mom, there's so much construction. One day it smelled horrible. The next day the breathing quality, he said, didn't seem so great. I was one of the ones that stood up because I'm in the oncology field, and I'm really nervous about the effects long-term for my 12-year-old son. And it's kind of almost over now, but I've been thinking about this, and I didn't really know what to do. They said that they did check, you know, that they're doing everything they can. They check the levels. The levels are okay, but I don't know enough and I'm so busy to research it or know what to do. So I'm just hoping and praying that my son and all these other children 30 years from now don't have these carcinogens or leukemia or anything. The school was, it's a wonderful place. It's just the school was a disaster with sheets and the, you should have seen it because we had to take a tour. There was a big parent meeting.
Well, Sherry, thank you, first of all, for raising your concerns, and I really appreciate your phone call. And I'll just put that to you, Dr. Carpenter, because, okay, so Sherry, a parent probably speaking for many parents out there who have some of these concerns, listening to David's reporting, listening to what you're saying right now, I mean, what guidance would you give to schools or school districts? Because obviously this is a very pricey thing. We would want to make sure that if there's toxic chemicals present in older schools, that they not be released into the environment or that they be remediated properly. But at the same point, this could cost billions and billions and billions of dollars to taxpayers. What do you say to parents like Sherry?
Well, in the first place, I think there is some responsibility of school boards to be sure that when there's remediation going on, it's done in the summer when the kids are not around. This is not just an issue with PCBs. It's with the dust, the particulate matter, the old lead from old paint. You know, old schools have a lot of dangerous things, and there should not be construction and remediation going on when kids are present. Now, the other issue is that, you know, it's just something that we all have to accept, that the big error was allowing these substances to be made and so widely used in the past when we didn't really understand how dangerous they were. And the reality is that none of us can totally avoid exposure. So what we have to do, the only rational thing to do at this point, is to take reasonable steps to reduce our exposure to the greatest degree possible without breaking the bank and without causing real problems economically. And the point you made is a good one. If there's a problem in Malibu where people have a little more money, many of these old schools are in poor districts, and there is not the tax base that can afford to build a new school, which would be the optimal solution to the problem. So we're going to have to accept some exposure, but we should be doing everything we can to reduce that exposure in ways that still are economically realistic.
John, I just want to make a quick point. Connecticut districts are eligible for some reimbursement if they have a project where they want to do a renovation and they include PCB remediation in that project. Now, if they just do a PCB remediation, that's not eligible for reimbursement. So just a little point of clarification in case districts out there might be confused about that. But Dr. Carpenter, when we're talking about paying and cost, one of the things that some districts across the country have done is they've gone to the original manufacturer of PCBs, which is Monsanto, to try to recoup some of these costs. Some districts in Massachusetts, I think there's districts in California that have done this. Certainly, it's an idea that is not without popularity. So I'm wondering what you think of having the industry that created these PCBs be on the hook for some of these costs.
Well, you know, the Monsanto may be a fairly wealthy corporation, but there's a limit to what they can cover as well. I'm aware that there are several lawsuits against Monsanto ongoing, specifically targeted on certain schools. You know, my sense is it's unlikely they're to go very far. I do hold corporations that manufactured dangerous products liable for the health effects. You know, this is part of our whole Superfund law. This is why GE is responsible for the contamination of the Housatonic and the Hudson. But there are many people involved. There's the manufacturer, there's the distributor, there's the local school boards and so forth. And, you know, there's a degree of changes in our understanding of how dangerous these compounds are. The time that most of them were used, there were no federal regulations, And so it's a very, very complicated, difficult issue.
We're talking with Dr. David Carpenter, who's director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany. Also with David DeRoche, who covers environment and also education for us here. He's an education reporter who's been covering the environment a lot recently because of his story about PCBs in public schools. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about PCBs in the Housatonic River, dumped there for decades by the General Electric Corporation up in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. We'll be finding out more about remediation efforts coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, a recent New York Times op-ed draws attention to Yale University's endowment and how their money is spent. The report found that more was spent on private equity fund managers to manage this large endowment than actually spent on students. This has prompted some renewed debate and criticism over big endowments at big schools. That's our conversation tomorrow. Hope you can join us here on Where We Live. Today we're talking about PCBs in our schools and in our environment. An investigation by WNPR's David DeRoche has looked at how PCBs are probably in most of the schools in Connecticut. And many schools have also tested and remediated for PCBs. We've been talking about the health impacts with Dr. David Carpenter, director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany. Joining us now is Tracy Iyett, who's a biologist with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, to talk about PCBs in the natural environment in one of the places we've been covering for years, the Housatonic River. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'm wondering first if you can just give us background on PCBs in the Housatonic River. I mentioned before the break that General Electric upstream had a plant in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. They dumped PCBs for a number of years. So what can you tell us about the Housatonic south of the Massachusetts border?
Sure. There are PCBs in Connecticut in the river, extending from the border from Massachusetts all the way down to the Derby Dam. And those PCBs are attributed back to the GE facility in Pittsfield. We discovered the PCB issue in Connecticut in the late 70s when biologists from DEP at the time went out and tested fish and found PCBs in the fish. And subsequently, the Department of Public Health issued a fish consumption advisory, which remains in place today for the Housatonic River. I think that prompted a lot of people in Connecticut and also in Massachusetts at EPA to take a look at what was going on in the river. And subsequently, Massachusetts also issued a fish consumption advisory. And that started a large conversation, which eventually resulted in a plan in 2000 for cleaning up the river in Connecticut and Massachusetts.
And that plan for cleaning up the river in 2000, this is decades and decades after the dumping first began. What has been happening in the Pittsfield, Massachusetts area, the first couple miles just downstream of the plant in Pittsfield where the dumping has been taking place?
So there was an extensive study to find out where the PCBs were in Massachusetts and Connecticut and the levels and is it in soil? Is it in sediment? Is it affecting the biota? Is it affecting people? So there was risk assessments done. And then based on those risk assessments, a plan was developed. And the first half mile of the river up in Pittsfield was cleaned up by the General Electric Company. And the next mile and a half was cleaned up by EPA. So the first 2 miles of the river has been addressed, but now we have from that 2 mile mark all the way down to the dam in Derby, Connecticut, that's called in EPA's plans the rest of the river. And so we're working through now the plan for what to do to address the contamination both in Massachusetts and Connecticut.
We were talking just before the break about whether or not companies that produce PCBs like Monsanto, which produced an awful lot of the caulking materials found in schools, might be on the hook for remediation of those schools. Something to note here is that GE has been working with the EPA and also the State Departments of Environmental Protection in Connecticut and in Massachusetts over the years to essentially work on their own remediation. Can you explain just how on the hook GE is for cleaning up their mess?
GE is responsible for the PCBs and for addressing the cleanup in both Connecticut and Massachusetts. And that legal document that was established in 2000, which is called a consent decree, and it was a document signed by GE, signed by the federal government and the two states, sets up a cleanup process whereby the public has input, and it's based on science to study and figure out what needs to be done. And then once the final plan for how to do the cleanup is done, GE is required to execute and complete that cleanup. Where we're at in the process right now is EPA had proposed a cleanup plan, has taken public comment. The public obviously provided comment. Massachusetts and Connecticut provided comment. EPA is considering those, and we're waiting for EPA to put forth their final plan. When they have their final plan, then there's an opportunity for GE or others to appeal it. But once that's done, the cleanup starts.
Well, let's go to the phones here. Timothy is calling from Lee, Massachusetts. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I head up a river group up in Berkshire County, and we've been fighting for the cleanup of the Housatonic since the early 90s. And I'd like to say that the cleanup of the Housatonic that has been proposed so far is way inadequate, and it's going to leave fish, at least up in Massachusetts, way high contaminated, probably some of the worst in the country. And they also are moving away from cleaning what are called sensitive habitats in the river where sensitive critters live. But in these areas, they have very high levels of PCBs. And these are being weakened down by EPA and by the state of Massachusetts in at least the last proposal that they had out about a year and a half ago. And we're expecting this new proposal. But as far as we know, there are no plans to clean anything up in Connecticut. That has been off the table since day one back in the 90s. And up here in Massachusetts, the plan seems to be so weak that the river will probably stay forever contaminated.
I'm wondering, Tim, if you could just quickly tell me what that public comment piece of this has been like. I know that Tracy talked about this, and I know that this has been a part of the ongoing effort here to get the community involved, the communities along the river. Do you feel that the community in your neck of the woods has had a voice in what's happening up there?
Well, there have been public comment periods, but in our 20 years of fighting the cleanup for the Housatonic, we have found that the public comments don't really go far enough into creating a adequate cleanup in our river. And we are worried about that scenario, that there are politics that are become involved in the actual way that they're going to clean up the river and how many PCBs are going to be taken out. And we feel that right now the picture on the horizon is that there are going to be way too many of these chemicals left in the river. And I talk about a new study that was just put out by North Carolina where the fish in the rivers in North Carolina are now found to have male and female sex organs on the same fish. And this is called endocrine disruption, and it's happening with polar bears. It's happening with wildlife all around the world. And this is because PCBs are the most, one of the most prevalent chemicals in the food chain of the earth. And this is a very serious thing when we start to have reproductive effects going on because of the PCBs.
Timothy, thank you very much for your phone call. Again, Timothy from, calling from Lee, Massachusetts. Any quick response to some of what Tim had to say, Tracy?
Sure. Tim is right that the main active area of remediation is going to occur in Massachusetts because the vast majority of the PCBs are in Massachusetts. So I'm representing the Connecticut interest here. And while we're not immediately proposing any sort of active remediation, that doesn't mean that we don't have an interest in, nor have we, we've put forth a proposal for how to best protect Connecticut. So to protect Connecticut, both our citizens and the animals and the environment that reside in the Housatonic River in Connecticut, what we need is a cleanup that reduces the amount of PCBs that are transported from Massachusetts into Connecticut to the greatest extent practicable.
And they're transported how? In the sediments at the bottom of the river? How do they get downstream?
PCBs like to adhere to sediment and to soil. And rivers are very dynamic systems. So as the river moves, it's moving soils, it's moving sediments, and the PCBs that are on those soils and sediments come into Connecticut.
And one of the concerns all along with the remediation that's happening in the north part of the Hudson River and the north part of the Housatonic River is some scientists are always concerned that the type of digging up and dredging that happens up near the contamination site may indeed loosen more PCBs and flush them downstream. What do we know about that movement, Tracy?
I would expect that in areas of active remediation, there is a potential for the PCBs to move into the water column. And once they get in the water column, they could transport down to Connecticut. So we'd be interested when the plan is designed for how they're going to implement the cleanup, to have safeguards in there to prevent as much resuspension of materials and monitoring so that if materials are resuspended, they could, and you know, it is too much for what's coming downstream, they could stop, they could make adjustments, and then continue on safely.
I'd like to ask Dr. David Carpenter quickly, if you would, to just talk about what we know about the biological impacts of fish and other wildlife species. I mean, many of us heard about PCBs the first time because of the diminution of the bald eagle population over the course of several decades. What do we know about how they impact some of our other denizens of the Housatonic River Valley, Doctor?
Well, we certainly know that PCBs are endocrine disruptors in addition to carcinogens and in addition to having effects on diseases like thyroid disease and diabetes. The big concern, well, there are really two levels of concern. One are the effects of PCBs on the animals in the along the river, especially fish, but not just fish, but you know, other animals that eat fish and animals that eat the insects that are off the river, because anything around the river is going to accumulate the PCBs, and they're going to migrate up the food supply. Then there's the issue of human exposure from eating the fish, and that's also a very important one.
I quickly want to get to Ken in Fairfield. Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Hopefully, Tracy can shed some light on this. I understand that GE is pressuring to end the dredging or the cleanup in the Hudson. But what a terrible irony is that I understand that they're still, and have been all along, able to dump a compromising amount of new PCBs into the river. So is that indeed, was that a compromise agreement?
Ken, thank you very much for your question. What do you know about that, Tracy?
I don't know the details of the cleanup in New York and whether or not GE is allowed to release more PCBs into the Hudson River, so I really couldn't speak to that.
Can you give us any guidance on how the Hudson River cleanup has differed from the Housatonic? Obviously, it's a much larger body of water. Other than that, what have we learned from the Hudson that we may be applying to the Housatonic cleanup?
Well, you're right. The Housatonic and the Hudson are very different river systems. The Hudson River is large, and it's deep and vast-moving, whereas the Housatonic River is a small river. It meanders. It has a high flood capacity, so it has a very vast floodplain that they're not needing to deal with in the Hudson River. So it's really quite different. So what technologies that they use in the Hudson River to do cleanup really wouldn't work as well in the Housatonic River because, again, the structure is that different. That said, we look at all studies so that we can learn both on a scientific basis and a management basis what worked and what didn't work so we can make the next cleanup a better cleanup.
We have just 1 minute left. David, go ahead.
Tracy, I'm just curious to know, are we monitoring the wildlife in the Housatonic and what is the status of the wildlife there?
So we actually have a cooperative agreement or had in the past a cooperative agreement with General Electric that every 2 years they would go out and collect samples of the insects that live in the river and the fish at multiple points in Connecticut. And they've continued to do that every 2 years. So we get information on how much PCBs are in the aquatic environment every 2 years. So it's decreased back from the 70s, but it's still there, and it's still there at a level that's unacceptable.
Tracy Iatt is a biologist with the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, giving us an update on the cleanup of the Housatonic River from the years of dumping of PCBs by General Electric up in Pittsfield. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks also to Dr. David Carpenter, who's director of the Institute for Health and the Environment at the University of Albany. Doctor, thank you so much for your expertise and your time. I appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
And I want to thank David DeRoche, WNPR's education reporter. His series on PCBs in schools is up on WNPR.org. If you want to find out more, take a look at a couple maps to find out more about where PCBs could be in schools. David, thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org/where we live. Our program today was produced by Lydia Brown. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.